Welcome to the Painting Insights podcast. We have been working on something in the background.
That's right. We've actually started a Patreon channel. For the last couple of months, we've had previous guests revisit the channel to give us additional content, everything from studio tours, sketchbook tours, talking us through the process of paintings, and all kinds of additional treats, which you're exclusively going to see as a patron who supports the channel.
So by supporting us on Patreon, you help the channel keep going. There's a lot of work put into this, from the video editing to the sourcing of guests. So you really help us find those guests and to put the content out.
And we have lots of content planned for the near future. So the links for that will be in the description of this video and in the description on the podcast channels. And otherwise, you can go on to Patreon and type in Painting Insights Podcast and support us that way. Thanks very much. Enjoy the video. Okay, so would you mind introducing yourself for the audience, please?
Hi, I'm Maria Rose ROI, ROI because I'm a member of the Royal Institute of Oil Painters. I'm a plein air painter for the most part. So I paint outside, usually with oils. I live in Devon and I paint all around the southwest England.
Fantastic. So, how long have you been a member of the Royal Institute of Oil Painters?
Just one, I'll be coming up to a year in the autumn. So I was made a full member in at the end of last year.
Exciting. What does that entail? What does being a member mean?
It's obviously very early days for me at the moment, but it's a prestigious society, part of the Federation of British Artists. I get the opportunity to show some of my paintings at Mall Galleries London once a year. And take part in events and exhibitions as part of the society. I've got a lot of friends in the society, so it's been something I've wanted to do for a long time. And it finally happened in last year.
So is it a good networking opportunity when there are events as well?
Yeah, definitely. We have a sort of summer picnic once a year, which I'm hoping to go to in a couple of weeks for the society and its friends. We run a friends scheme so people can join that and have access to the members and events and things.
Lovely. That's
Yeah.
wonderful. So, for anyone who's not watching the podcast, can you describe your art style for anyone who's listening to the audio platform?
So I tend to work relatively small in sort of a la prima single sessions for the most part of my work. So quite a sort of loose impressionistic style. I favour a sort of fairly muted colour palette. I love blues and mauves, so anything with a bit of aerial perspective or the sea I'm very drawn to. I paint around the coast of Devon and southwest England, so a lot of coastal work, and trying to sort of keep it loose and not too fiddly and detailed.
No, it's beautiful work. Sorry, Richard, do you have any questions?
Yeah, absolutely. I've loved your work for a long time, Maria,
Oh, thank you.
and congratulations on the ROI thing. I mean, it
Thanks.
is. I mean, it's a real achievement, and it's excellent.
So,
Are you in North Devon or South Devon?
I'm on the border of Mid and North Devon. So yeah, I'm technically North Devon, but I'm not actually anywhere near the sea. It takes me about an hour to drive to the sea from here. So I've got lovely views to Dartmoor and Exmoor. And I live on a sort of high up bit of land in between the two moors.
Beautiful, beautiful place. I used to
Yeah,
live.
it is. It's lovely.
Yeah.
It
So,
really
do
is.
you have a favourite place that you're drawn to that you go painting? That if you were to wake up in the morning ready to paint, that you would be drawn to?
I wouldn't say any one particular place, and it does sort of depend on the weather, the season, my mood, but anywhere by the sea, really.
Yeah.
And we're lucky because we've got such a varied coastline around here that it kind of it would depend on a few factors, but yeah, as long as I'm by the sea, then I know I'm probably going to be able to get something's going to catch my eye and inspire me.
It's interesting. I haven't been back down to Devon for about 10 years, and I went last year and drove down to Cornwall from Devon. And what I noticed, and I forgot this, is how many shadows there actually are there. Because here in East Anglia, it's very flat and very open, so we don't get many shadows from the
Oh,
hill, from the cliffs. And I found it really fascinating just how the light was different. Not necessarily the light in the sky was different, but how it was working on the land. Is that important to you when you paint to find those elements where you have shadows? Does it help your composition?
yeah, it's something I really try and look for actually, especially if I'm doing a landscape rather than a seascape. So where I live, it is really hilly. And you get some really interesting shadow play on a small scale, say tree shadows running up a hill. So where you can see all the branches kind of shadowed. I love painting that. That kind of high contrast, for example, if it's snowed or there's frost, the sort of stark blue shadows against the bright sunlit shadows, that's something else that will always kind of catch my eye. On a larger scale, then yeah, so if I was painting a big vista like Dartmoor, it does make it more interesting if you've got some of that relief shown in shadow or cloud shadows racing across the
Yeah.
landscape.
Especially in Dartmoor, that happens a lot, doesn't it? That you get those cloud shadows. Cool.
And actually, painting that sort of huge landscape, it can be weirdly sort of flat looking if you catch the light wrong and everything's sunlit and there's no, you can't see the shadows. So it does sort of make it harder. So yeah, shadows are actually quite an important part of the things I look for in a landscape.
And we've talked to other plein air artists about this, and it's probably a question that you get asked a lot. Do you paint in response to what's happening, or do you, when you arrive on the scene, sort of capture what you first see, or do you shift things around to your advantage?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. It depends on what's happening, and I guess I try and not chase the light too much because you can end up losing what you were initially drawn to, or it can sort of muddy your painting a bit if you start trying to sort of take a different direction halfway through. But that said, if you're painting for a 2 hour period, things do change, and sometimes something will present itself that actually really benefits the painting. So, or yeah, things would move, people come in, or animals even, or the tide changes it. So I think it would depend whether it's sort of beneficial to the kind of overall composition, or if it's just something I just can't resist, like a boat with a sail comes in or something, then yeah. But making sort of whole scale changes to a light situation in a painting, kind of once you've sort of made a start, that's trickier.
Yeah, absolutely. And just bringing it back to hilly lands, flat lands, you've recently been in Katwijk, Holland, which is.
Catbike, yeah.
Just a quick story. I worked there as an 18-year-old in a fish factory in Katwijk, and
Oh, really?
in gold fields as well. And I know Mo Tew, so I know her sons, and
Yeah.
worked in the bulb fields with them. But that's a fascinating landscape. How was your experience out there painting?
I loved it. It was very different to obviously what I have in Devon. It was genuinely very flat. I was by the coast a lot, so I guess I didn't really get the I didn't get a sense of the sort of the flatness of the land as such. But I mean, even the sea was sort of different. You know, I'm kind of used to that, the big Atlantic beaches with huge tides. You know, you can walk half a mile down to the sea when the tides right out at somewhere like Croyde or Saunton. The sea in Katwijk, it didn't really move, and I found that really weird. I don't know what the tide difference is there, but it was negligible, and I kept sort of waiting for the sea to disappear off, and it didn't. It just stayed there. So that was a novelty for me because it meant I could spend a bit longer observing that sort of tide line without it disappearing off and having to chase it up and down the beach. And yeah, big skies.
How do you adapt as a plein air painter to that? Because it's that thing if you kind of get used to, like we're talking about Devon there in your environment and knowing that. Do you find when you arrive somewhere like that that it's you're really having to sort of concentrate more or adapt to it?
I think it helps to sort of not be too ambitious to start with. I mean, I was traveling on a plane anyway, so I was kind of limited in what size I could work in. So I was working on quite small panels just to try and get my eye in initially. It wasn't helped by the fact that, yeah, it was really, really dreadful weather as well. So it was a challenging week. And, you know, I guess I didn't maybe feel like I was painting my best. There was a few that I kind of thought, yeah, that's maybe kind of heading in the direction that I want it to. So it's a learning curve. And if we'd had steadier weather, then yeah, maybe I probably would have found my feet a bit quicker. But we had everything thrown at us very quickly. So, so yeah, keep your panel size small and just keep sketching and sort of. I did a lot of sitting and just sort of looking as well and trying to get used to the colours and the kind of compositions.
Simon?
How has your plein air kit evolved with these types of trips? Has it changed much?
Not in recent years, no. I generally favour a sort of half box easel for painting here, and I did make the investment of a sort of smaller lightweight Pochard box for taking abroad a couple of years ago. So that was good because traveling with a box easel is really difficult. So this is just a nice little wooden thing that you can pack in a suitcase quite easily. But that's probably the only sort of bit of kit that I've had to invest in to travel particularly. That and the sort of camera tripod that it goes with.
I was wondering when you said about the smaller boards that you use, do you go to send smaller brushes? Do you have a set number of brushes or?
No, I took my usual brushes. They weren't dramatically smaller than I would usually work, but I didn't take any of the kind of larger sizes that I work in, and I did just stick to, you know, sort of, 10 by 8 sort of size for the majority of the week. So no, I stick to the same palette, same colours, same brushes. I don't, in a sort of high pressure situation like that, I don't want any new bits of kit that I'm not used to that might kind of take me by surprise.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm always curious as well as how many brushes painters use. Do you have a, you have to have a large assortment or do you have a reduced amount?
Well, I try and keep it fairly reduced just so that it's not extra weight to carry around. But I like a good selection of different shapes and you know, hog and synthetic. So I use both sort of hog and synthetic brushes for different effects. I've got some little watercolor riggers for detail and I find it tends to sort of grow and grow the amount of brushes that I carry around with me until I get to a point where I think, no, I'm going to have to edit this down again because it's just becoming a bit unwieldy. But if you've, yeah, it's a balance. I think if you've got a decent amount of brushes with you, then you don't you can just move on and pick some clean brushes. So I have multiples of each. So if I'm doing more than one painting in a day, then I've got a clean set that I can move to. But yeah, it's just making sure you're not taking extra weight with you when you're painting outside.
Yeah. And is there a company that you found reliable brushes, as manufacturers?
I've sworn by Pro-Arte brushes for years, and I use their silver-handled acrylics brushes. But I've got to say, I've slightly noticed a decreasing the quality of them lately, which I'm a bit upset about because I haven't found anything else that quite gives me the same feeling. So I'm exploring Rosemary and Co's synthetic brushes at the moment, and they seem really good. They're still not quite the same, so I'm on the lookout for a good springy, soft synthetic brush.
Out of curiosity, is it the sable that has lessened in quality that you've noticed?
It's a sort of white synthetic bristle,
How is it?
but it's just I'm finding a lot of the older brushes that I've got I'm still using, and they've kept their shape and they've got a sort of weight to them. The newer ones that I've bought to replace them, I've already finished with because they've splayed at the ends and they just feel a little bit thinner. So yeah, it's a bit upsetting. I'd rather pay more and have the same quality, to be honest. But
Yeah.
I haven't
Have
written
you
to Pro-Arte yet to complain.
tried their bristling range?
I have given that a try. It's still not
Still
quite.
not. It's interesting, isn't it? Like, because I use RGM palette knives, and you get so used to the tool you're using, and I would use a number, I think it's 31, and it's all I use the same. They shifted their manufacture base from Italy, where they were traditionally made, to China, and it completely changed. And
Right.
just the angle of them was slightly different, and it totally threw me out because I ran out of my Italian ones. And then I started to use it, and it's almost I had to learn how to use it again,
Yeah.
just the weight of it, the angle. And then I got used to using those, and I found one of the Italian ones, and I couldn't use it. So it's strange, you adapt.
Yeah, I'll have to adapt at some point, I think,
Yeah.
when all this might have been put in the bin. But for now, I'm sort of just trying to get used to some of the new rosemary brushes that I've treated myself to.
You also do beautiful still life paintings, and I wanted to ask about how
Thanks.
you come up with what you want to paint as a subject. Is it just circumstance and you see beautiful things? Because they just look lovely and perfectly lit.
Thanks. I think it still life's I think the setup of a still life probably takes longer than the actual painting, and there's a lot of fiddling around and trying to sort of come up with the lighting and composition that works. It's actually quite difficult in my house because I live in a it's quite an old house. It's a sort of extreme light situation. It's either completely dark or you've got direct sunlight. So it's trying to sort of have your still life lit in a attractive way, whilst also having enough light on your easel to see. I've always collected antiques and spend a lot of time sort of at antiques markets and thrifting and things. So I've over the years built up quite a good collection of sort of attractive still life worthy objects. So that helps. And I think there's a sort of balance between choosing an object because it'll be beneficial to a composition, but also kind of thinking that there might be a little narrative to go with it so that it sort of makes sense as an arrangement.
Yeah. But it's also the, because on the surface of, I'm looking at the one where you've done lemons in a bowl, and you have this lovely cloth on the top, and it just adds so much as well, having that lovely texture, because it's not, doesn't look like a just a standard tablecloth. It's actually really beautiful how the light is, reflecting on it. And is it, is that part of the setup that you're thinking, which surface does this work best on?
Yeah, definitely. Just I guess when I'm looking at a landscape, I'm trying to sort of find a way in and find a composition that I can that I know I can that'll be sort of you can replicate in a sort of strong way on a 2D surface. And it's just the same with a still life, really. I try and almost think of it like a landscape. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
And you say,
interesting.
sorry,
Oh.
go ahead, Richard. Sorry.
Cezanne, when he would do still lives, he'd often spend the whole day, trying to arrange this, and then, painting time run out, and then the next day get up and just rearrange it again.
Yeah, and then the lights changed and you have
Yeah.
to rearrange it. Yeah. I feel like composition is probably one of my weaker points as a painter. Something I'm really trying to push myself always with and learn and get my head around it. My partner is also a painter, Tom Stevenson, whose work you might know. He's got a really good eye for composition, and he's really good at setting up still life. Sometimes I will just call on his help to help me come up with something, and he's got a good eye for it. And yeah, I guess some people have that. And yeah.
What are the things that you've found out about composition? Is there anything that you've gleaned from him?
I think there's some people that just have such a natural intuition for it. And it's a really difficult thing to learn. I think so often I look at something and think that's going to work, and then it really doesn't. I think doing a sort of preliminary sketch or drawing does help. I'm a bit naughty about doing that. I get so excited about painting that I just usually skip straight to painting, and then Tom's like, "Oh, did you do a drawing before you started?" "No, I didn't." "Well, then that's why your composition is really terrible." So, it's definitely worth spending the time to do a couple of sketches and work out the problems in a drawing first. There's a couple of sort of simple rules that I think are probably quite well known amongst artists, the rule of thirds, and then kind of making sure your horizon line is sort of directing your eye to the sort of focal point. So I'll be thinking about whether my sort of focal point is, so if I was painting the sea, do I want the sea to sort of fill up most of my canvas, or do I maybe want to move the horizon low and make the interest area the sky? I think you want to avoid just putting it halfway. That's a pretty basic sort of rule of composition, isn't it? But it is helpful to be aware of and thinking about. And then yeah, making sure you're or it can help to have your focal point on one of the thirds. I think those are two really simple, quick things that I try and think about when I'm composing a painting.
Because it's the framework in many ways, isn't it? For then you can be expressive with your colours, your brushwork, your tonal thing. But the
It
comp
really is, yeah.
yeah.
It's so important. I think if you've got a strong composition, that is half the battle won at the very start.
Absolutely.
So,
Absolutely.
colour composition, something you're more comfortable with. You don't struggle when it comes to making the colours or the tones composed go, quite harmoniously, I suppose.
Yeah, I think colour's probably my main driver and interest when it comes to painting. So I think I'm probably guilty of maybe sacrificing the composition sometimes in order to explore a particular arrangement of color and tone that's sort of catching my eye. And you can use a bit of artistic license when you're observing a scene, and you don't have to replicate something exactly. Sorry, I've completely lost my train of thought.
Right, color composition wise, you're quite comfortable because it looks as though there's less struggle there. I mean, I wouldn't have seen compositional issues, or I haven't with any of your work anyway, but what is your color palette? Could I ask, can you take us through the colors that you use?
It's not sort of a super reduced palette, like a lot of plein air painters use. I've sort of arrived at a kind of happy, as a happy compromise. So I've got titanium white and Michael Harding warm white, which is a little bit more transparent. It's got a bit of warmth. It's a quite a nice mixing white, and helps your mixes not get too chalky. And then Naples yellow, I use a lot of, especially in skies. And then cadmium scarlet, which is just slightly more to the orange than cadmium red, which I find a bit more sympathetic to nature. And then quinacridone magenta. I used to use alizarin, but I find this has got slight. It's slightly transparent. It's got a nice freshness, crispness to it. Maybe that alizarin doesn't. Yellow ochre, cadmium yellow, cadmium lemon, viridian, oxide of chromium, raw umber, and then I've got three blues on my palette: ultramarine, cobalt, and a little tiny bit of phthalo blue, which can be useful for when you are blessed with nice turquoise seas.
How has it evolved, Maria? How your color palette, how has it evolved over time?
It's pretty much stayed the same probably for the last, I don't know, 8 or so years. It hasn't evolved much since I was sort of kind of finding my feet with painting. So occasionally I find a new color will interest me, and it'll creep onto my palette. And again, like your brushes, I sort of have to edit it down again every now and then, and just stop it from becoming too unwieldy. So you want had sort of developing that intuitive color mixing is particularly important with plein air painting for your speed. So as I'm not constantly changing what colors I use, it becomes second nature, and I don't then struggle if I've mixed up a pool of color and run out. I'm not thinking, oh gosh, what did I mix that up with? I know. If I want to then tweak stuff in the studio, I know what colors I've mixed. It just, I don't have to think about it too hard.
It just becomes part of you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Maria, you're saying also about when you were just finding your feet. So, what got you started? Where was your journey? And especially when your journey to plein air painting?
So I mean, I've always painted and drawn, probably like a lot of artists. That was my favorite hobby as a child. It was the subject I excelled at most at school. Went to university and did fine art. Probably like a lot of people, the fine art degree that I did was maybe not the best suited to me. It was a very conceptual course. I didn't really thrive on it. They didn't really teach figurative painting. I was really lucky because our sort of technician demonstrator at the time was Martin Brooks, who is a member of the Royal Portrait Society now. He's an incredible draftsman, and he was the sort of saving grace of the course for me, really. He taught my drawing, and he taught me a little bit about the sort of the technicalities of oil painting, prepping canvases, priming, that sort of thing. So it was worth it for that. But I can't say that I kind of graduated feeling like it was It wasn't really 3 years well spent.
Yeah.
I met Tom, so that was great. And then after university, I didn't paint for years. Went into full-time work. I went to the RA summer show with my best friend one summer, and I noted the work of Ken Howard and Bernard Dunstan and Fred Cumming. Hadn't actually been exposed to them at that point. And I think it was from sort of starting to read up about them that I discovered Peter Brown, and this thing called plein air painting. So I just thought, oh, I'll go and give that a try, and loved it, and it just sort of clicked, and that was it. Then I was addicted, and got to the point where I was getting a bit of traction on Instagram, and some nice positive comments there, and that kind of spurred me on. And then I guess at some point it sort of entered my head that it might actually be feasible to kind of try and push this professionally. So that became my sort of main goal, to kind of be a professional, and then maybe not have the job alongside it.
Great. And you do workshops as well, and you do all of that kind of stuff. Is that a recent thing? Have you always done them?
No, it's quite recent. I think I went full time with painting in 2021, and it's become a useful other source of income. I do find it quite. I'm not a sort of natural teacher, I'm having to really learn that, and I've had some very kind guidance from particularly Peter Keegan and my friend Hannah Twine. They're both artists with a huge wealth of experience in teaching, and they've been mentoring me with that. And I'm getting there. I'm finding my feet now. I think I've got. I think once you've got to the point where you've got a kind of structure, and what you're going to go in and teach people, that helps. So I've done a lot more of that in the last sort of year or so, and I am enjoying it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it kind of, it's one of those things that you do like with painting. You get much more accustomed to and kind of tweak it as you go along, and you evolve as a teacher. But it's great as well, sort of sharing those skills, because I teach as well, and often when I paint, I'm not sure what I'm doing as I'm doing it, but if I'm doing it in a class in a demo or something, people say, "So how are you doing that?" And I said, "I'm not quite sure. Let me sort of deconstruct that and explain."
Forces you to articulate things
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
have maybe become intuitive, or and it forces you to really think about your process as well.
Absolutely.
And it has really sort of crystallized in my head things that I haven't been able to put words to, some really fundamental things about my practice that was sort of a revelation to myself, actually, to become conscious of it. So I think before teaching, I'd not really ever given any thought to what an important role desaturation plays in my colour mixing. And it's through teaching that I've realised that that's something that is really integral to my painting, and that actually it's not something that maybe people give a lot of thought to when they're sort of beginning painting. It's been really great to be able to sort of share that with people and make people bring that awareness to people, because a lot of
Yeah.
people find it really, they've heard about tone, they've heard about the color wheel, but maybe haven't given any thought to the kind of intricacies of desaturation to
Yeah.
achieve naturalistic palette. And it's been really good to sort of realize that about my painting, and to help
Absolutely.
people do that.
And you kind of then learn more about your own work. It's interesting. And with the desaturation, are you using sort of complementary colours to do that? Yeah.
So that's why my palette is perhaps It's got a few more colours on it than is, I think some plein air painters do keep a very reduced palette and, simply go with that kind of warm and a cool of each primary and then, a white and a whatever else. But so I keep the pre-mixed greens on my palette almost primarily because of their use in desaturating and creating greys.
Yes, with your reds, and then if
Red
you've got the
yeah.
whole range of all
Yeah.
grey within that. Yeah, it's interesting because I mainly use a limited palette, just three primaries plus whites. But my basic thing is your primaries make your secondaries, but then what do you do? You can't make a painting out of primaries and secondaries. So then it's using the complementary color combinations to then create those whole range of browns and grays and how you can shift that from warm to cool. It's fascinating.
Yeah, color temperature is not something that is maybe as talked about in when
Yeah.
people are learning to paint, and it's quite revolutionary to some people, I
Yeah,
think,
absolutely.
about temperature. And I think yeah, that if you've got the tone and you've got your temperature, it sort of it the painting will work even if the color's not exactly like what you're seeing in front
Yes.
of you.
Yeah.
So it's interesting it to try and get people to free up their color mixing by thinking in those terms rather than painting over making exact colors and thinking about, like you say, those colors in between. It's
Yeah.
a world of different grays
Yeah. It's
that you
endless.
have to with just
Yeah.
a few complementaries. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I always see complementaries in a sense of all the warm and cool of colors, very much like, and I'll often explain, it's like, in paintings, you want this thing of dark and light and then everything in between. And then, sometimes, horizontal lines or marks, vertical, diagonal. So you've got those sort of contrasts. But then it's the same for the warm and cool, and the warm and cool is just as important. It's just another kind of scale which you can use in it. So, Maria, do you teach regular classes, or do you travel around doing workshops? What do you do?
At the moment, it will be workshops every couple of months. I'm trying not to sort of overload my schedule at the moment because I'm quite new to it, because I do get quite nervous about it. I sort of finding a balance, and so I've got a couple of workshops coming up later this year, and I've got details on my website. And then I do one-to-one tuition as well, so that's been really nice to do. That's a bit sort of yeah, a bit less nerve-wracking than
Yeah.
leading a whole group of people.
Yeah.
I quite like just doing the sort of one-to-one
Yeah.
tuition. I've done a couple of days.
Do you find, with a much better at it now, but you sort of schedule a workshop and then you think, oh, it's cool, it's in 3 weeks' time, and then it's getting closer and you start to get more and more wound up, and then think, what have I done? Why did I do this? But then you get there and it's absolutely fine and
Yeah,
amazing.
I know it's silly, I have a really sleepless night beforehand, and then once I'm there, like, this is great. I love talking about painting.
Yeah.
I've got a lot to say about painting, and I don't know why I get nervous about it, but I guess there's a lot of variables. You've always got
Yeah.
different people. You're responsible for the kind of dynamic of the people working together,
Yeah.
and I think I make life hard for myself by doing plein air painting workshops, because then you've got to contend with the weather, which adds a whole another layer of chaos
Yeah.
to it.
And you
So,
want to make it right, and that's the thing. I think if you didn't care, it's sort of just like, yeah, it's just all, but it's that kind of,
I want people to enjoy themselves and
yeah.
come away feeling like they've learned something and it's a worthwhile experience. So, I wouldn't go into it just thinking I'm just going to coast this. I give a lot to
Absolutely.
it.
So
Is it all in person, or do you teach online as well?
It's mostly in person. I've done a couple of online demos, but no online teaching as such. It's just been demos.
You
But yeah,
prefer the in-person.
at the moment, I think I'd like to do some online tutoring at some point, but I haven't quite got my head around it yet. I think when I'm feeling really sort of blasé about in-person teaching, maybe that'll be the time to explore taking it online.
Suppose it's a bit of a different thing altogether, is it? Teaching in person. And if I could, what's your relationship and experience been with galleries? What's that been for you?
I've been so lucky in that I've had really good experience with all of my galleries. So I've been with I've got I think it's about five different galleries that I give work to on a sort of relatively ad hoc basis. So I've not done a solo exhibition yet. I do a joint exhibition with my partner Tom, with my sort of main gallery, Grandi Art. So she Georgie Grandi, she's based in London. And she takes the most of my work, so I give her she'll run sort of regular mixed exhibitions, and I give her a selection of paintings for those every couple of months. And I've heard other artists with their sort of gallery horror stories, and I'm so grateful that that's not been me. All my gallery and gallerists have been really laid back, informal, trustworthy, just great people to work with. So it works for me. I think, like a lot of artists, I struggle with the selling thing. And doing direct sales is obviously, you're not paying your gallery commission, so that is really important to my bottom line. I'd say the majority of my sales are probably through my galleries, and that suits me because they deal with all the stuff we don't want to.
Well, having five galleries, have you spread them out? Are they kind of distanced from each other so that there's no issue with competition in that area?
So I've got a gallery, like I said, in London, and I give her work with the most regularity, and then White Space in South Devon. Odd Gallery in Wimborne in Dorset, and then Vandlis Gallery in Exeter. So yeah, they're sort of spread out geographically, and I tend to try and tailor the work that I give them specifically to their galleries and what sort of works best for them. So I think there's a sort of there's a nuance in the work that I give them as well, so there's not that kind of crossover.
That's nice. Sorry.
You do your own framing, Maria.
Framing is a sort of love-hate relationship. You do your own framing.
Well, I've got someone that makes really nice sort of, I call them blanks now, so I do all of the finishing and stuff on it. But I did go through a phase of actually trying to make the frames and realized it takes a long time.
So yeah, I guess I've got that kind of arrangement at the moment in that I get the wooden rims sent to me, and then I've got a sort of wholesale account with a framer. So I get the wooden frames, and then I gesso, paint, gild, do whatever to finish them. So that's a good compromise. I did used to do the whole framing thing with a Morso cutter and underpinner, and that's great because you can order all the different moldings that you want, and it does keep the costs much lower. But it's having the space for that equipment, and I don't in my current house, so.
And it takes ages as well.
Yeah, well, I think the frames probably take me longer than the actual paint. And I do really enjoy it. I am a framing geek. I love learning about framing. But at certain points of the year when I have multiple exhibitions coming up, then I spend more time framing than painting, and that is perhaps a false economy. I mean, I'm just framing, framing to death, framing 12 hours a day. You know, it's horrible. But I'm at a slight disadvantage geographically because I'm miles away from any framers where I am. So I use a good framer down in Dawlish for big frames because I haven't really got the expertise or the setup here to be able to deal with a larger frame. But I am a perfectionist, and I've got a certain look that I like with my frames, and I like to see the process through end to end. So it is what it is at the moment. I'm doing my frames, and one day I'd like to outsource it, but at the moment it's not really feasible for multiple reasons.
And you've kind of got control over the whole.
And lead-in times as well. I mean, most framers, they've probably got a month, 6 week lead-in times, and I'm not that organized. A lot of the time I'm literally scrabbling around for work right up to my gallery deadlines. So especially if, like this year the weather's been so bad, I'm quite behind on things. So I'll be painting right up to my deadlines. And then I don't have the luxury of being able to give a dry painting to a framer months before I need it.
Absolutely. I know that feeling very well.
So that helps. I can turn around a frame in a couple of weeks if I get the delivery dates right.
Well, you mentioned earlier about galleries being one of your main places for selling your work. Do you sell work online as well?
I do, yeah. I mean, I've got a Shopify website. So I've got it set up to do the whole e-commerce thing. And I will try and sell off Instagram and social media. It's difficult. I've got to be honest and say it's not a thriving business for me doing the direct sales. But I think that the galleries are so good at the sales thing. They're experts. They know what they're doing. And I don't really. I'm trying. I learn. I'm trying to learn. I've got a lot of art marketing Instagrams that I follow. But it's a tricky business, I think. But trying to sell off social media, there's a lot of people are being bombarded with information these days. It's very hard to pierce people's consciousness enough to make them go to your website and buy something. So
And it's getting harder and harder. I mean, the algorithm changes, and just the amount of artists on Instagram as well. And I think the golden age for it was the lockdown.
yeah, and I didn't realize quite what a bubble that was, actually. I think my Instagram and related sales had been growing steadily while I was sort of working full time. And like a lot of people, the pandemic went to my head and I quit my job, like I said, in 2021, off the back of what was actually a really buoyant art market. Hadn't fully appreciated that kind of pandemic bubble. And then crashed straight into the cost of living crisis in 2022, and that was a humbling experience. I had, you know, I've had to. It's an ongoing learning curve, I think.
And it's interesting. I talk a lot about this as well. It's this sort of nowadays how, artists kind of have to diversify and, still remain professional artists. But, I do all kind of things. So, I teach, I sell paintings via my website. I'm represented by a few galleries, so they sell paintings. Just opened a gallery, so I sell my paintings there, but also take commission. Teach in person, teach online, to do mentoring. So it's all of these kind of things that just facilitate then me to paint kind of what I want to paint, and because there's always the difficulty, isn't there, when you think, what will sell, and it's really hard. I mean, I think being an artist has always been an insecure profession. But it's when you kind of live it, you really see. But you're doing the right thing, that you're doing your workshops, you're doing your work, you're framing yourself, you've got your work in those other galleries, you've got all of these kind of things. And sometimes one is up here and it's
Yeah.
bringing it in. Sometimes it's the other thing and it's like that. But you're
Yeah.
doing it, and that's the
Yeah,
main
absolutely.
thing.
And I think pretty much every day I wake up, I think, God, I'm doing this. It's talking just about, and it's very, very feast and famine. But you get to this point where you're thinking, oh my God, this is going really badly. And then suddenly, like you say, something will shift, and you'll have a good month, and you think, oh no, that's okay. I'm all right for another month now. And but I think if there's anyone who listens to this who is in that situation where they've got a job alongside painting, I was there for so long and it was so hard. But I think there's something to be said for doing part-time work alongside painting, and
Absolutely.
then keeping the bits of the sort of painting that you like. I think there's a sort of two ways to do it, and that's that I'm doing it fully all in, multiple streams of income, bit of everything. My partner Tom, he has a part-time job alongside his painting, and he gets to say no to the things that he doesn't want to do, so he's a bit more in control of, he doesn't fancy doing that commission, he's just going to turn it down, so, and there's something to be said for that. The sort of financial liberation of a small amount of steady income alongside your painting.
And I think it's that thing of you can sort of dip your toe into stuff. But the key thing for an artist is really, I think, what it all revolves around, and it's the actual painting and being able to paint what you want to paint. I think when there is this greater sort of financial pressure on, there's always that temptation, or maybe the not necessarily a temptation, but in consideration of taking on commissions you don't necessarily want to do, maybe even changing one's style to suit a certain thing. But I think whatever facilitates that creative freedom and your painting is what it should be all about. If that means you go work in a completely unrelated job for a few days a week, but you have that, and ultimately and eventually that will pay off, because people buy and then want that work that's got that integrity in there. You don't have to be a starving artist.
I think it's interesting, because I think when I was working full time alongside painting, I was imagining this sort of glorious life of just uninhibited painting time, and just and actually I wouldn't say that I've got a whole lot more time painting for me than I did when I was working alongside, because it is taken up with commissions, teaching, making sure I've got work for galleries. I've just come to the end of a couple of sort of big commissions that I had, and I know my diary's looking quite free in August, and I'm like, oh, this is very exciting. I'm gonna be able to go out and just paint what my heart wants for the moment. So just need the weather to
I think it will. August is
Oh,
going
I think,
Let's hope.
yeah.
Well, for anyone who is watching or listening, where would you like them to go if they can support you, see your work, and purchase it?
Well, my website is the best starting point for that. So mariarose.co.uk. And I've got all the information about what I offer in workshops and teaching, and commissions. And I've got a selection of paintings for sale on there. I think, like a lot of artists, I've got an awful lot of paintings in my studio that I haven't managed to get into a gallery online, so I think it's always worth coming directly to me if there's things you've got in mind that might not be on my website.
Okay, lovely. And obviously, I recommend people go and see your Instagram, because you've created an amazing Instagram there. It's just beautiful work.
Oh,
But
thank you.
also, what's What is your Shopify called? Is it just your name? Is it any
Yeah,
variation?
just mariarose.co.uk. So I've got my own URL.
Oh, fantastic.
It's got that good sort of shop back end that
I use it
oh,
too.
yeah, it is actually. I mean, I feel
Well,
really bad for, web designers and creating websites because they have created something very very easy to use and
Yes.
for a sort of small scale a kind of e-commerce business, it's good. I'm not being paid, I just quite like
I
it.
recommend it too. It's all of the something sells, you hear a little cha-ching sound. It's a very nice sound.
That does happen every now and then, and I'm like,
it,
I want to hear more of that cha-ching,
yeah.
please.
It's usually like listening to a podcast or something like that and just like completely not fit, and then suddenly that sounds.
I was on the phone to Tom the other day and I heard it go, and I was like, oh, it's probably just a pack of greeting cards or something. And then I just someone had bought a painting. I
Yeah,
was
brilliant.
like, doesn't get old, it's never not exciting, I think.
Absolutely.
Well, we do encourage all the listeners and viewers, the links are in the description of the video and the audio podcast. Please go and support the artist because Maria's work is absolutely beautiful. You've been really generous with your time. Thank you so much for being a
Oh,
guest.
thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks, Maria. Thank
Thank
you.
you. Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode. If you can support the podcast by leaving a like or a comment down below, that'd really be great. But what we'd really like is if you're able to leave a review on the podcast channels, wherever you listen to it or download it, because that helps us get spread around the internet so that more people have access to us and able to see what we're making.
Also, follow us on Instagram, and we'd really appreciate it if you like and engage with our posts. Help get the podcast better known. Thanks for listening.